On the new Josh Nason's Punch-Out, John Pollock of Post Wrestling returns to talk about the retirement of George St. Pierre, my sudden hate watch love for Bellator, and even a little post wrestling news. Josh Nason's Punch-Out, WrestlingObserver.com, right now. Hey, everybody. Josh Nason. Josh Nason's Punch Out here. Welcome back. It is, Friday, February 22nd, by the time you're probably listening to this. And let's see. All types of stuff's been happening this week. GSP retired. All kinds of other stuff. ZOC events weekend. I just got off the phone with our guest this week, so we talked for about an hour. So I'm kind of coming down from that. John Pollock, post-wrestling, returned. Because I wanted to ask him, as a proud Canadian, what his thoughts were on George St. Pierre calling it good. And then we ventured into some other topics as well. We started talking about post-wrestling and how that's going, challenges. We started ventured into a media conversation. I talked a little bit about how, for some reason, people think that our site is co-opted with AEW. And that I'm a ticket shill because I sent an email that happened to have a link to a story about how to buy tickets for Double or Nothing. And then we went into Bellator, where I ranted for a good 30 seconds to a minute about how Bellator has kind of turned into a hate watch for me. And I say it with all due respect to the organization and the fighters there. But there, after this past weekend, I was furious, pissed. Anyone that would listen, I would tell about how pissed off I was at Bellator. But let's get to all that with our guest, John Pollock. So again, we hit up all these topics and more. We went for just over an hour. We're originally going to go for like 35 minutes or so. So if you have to split this up into two listens, do so. It's one of my, this podcast really turned out good. And the conversation was great. This is exactly what I'm, you know, trying to aim for every show I do. And this was good. So if you have to split it up, you guys will enjoy it. Trust me. So let's get right to it. Josh Nason, John Pollock, a bunch of topics, including GSP, right about now. Well, everyone, joining me at this time is past multi-time guest, and actually I have not talked to him on the phone or in this manner since May 25th, according to Skype, and it's been far too long, Memorial Day weekend almost that was, I believe, and it is almost a year later, so good time to check in with John Pollock, even though he's never too far from my heart or my dreams. John, what's going on?
I'm here both... in your heart, in your spirits, and via our Skype connection. I feel a real connection already, Josh.
I am always impressed by your performance.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Just immediately, the ultimate segue, Josh Nason.
The ultimate warrior, ultimate segue, all that good stuff. You are, of course, of post-wrestling. Your venture, we'll talk more about that in a few minutes, but things are, as you and I were talking about, might as well just let people know, things are good with John. We were just talking before we started hitting record, and yeah, things are good, and things are busy with you as always.
Yes, in fact, you can't see this. No one can see this because this is a podcast, but I am holding a limited edition post-wrestling coaster. And to see our logo on a coaster that I can put a hot or cold beverage on, I think the true sign of success, Josh.
You know you've made it when you have your own coaster.
That's it. I'm kind of done.
You guys have koozies yet?
No. Actually, you're not the first person that has said, what about koozies? As soon as Way posted a photo of one of these, someone said, hey, about a koozie. So I guess, you know, like baby steps, realistically. I guess the coaster does not define success. The koozie is now the next mountain to climb.
When I want to think of you guys, I want to be drinking. I mean, I think that's probably the best best compliment anyone can give. All right, so let's get into it here because we're going to talk about three topics on my mind, but I'm not going to tell you what they are. One of them you know already, but you're going to say. I'm just going to go at random here. I have wrote them down actually in Post-it notes, John. Let's see how much
of a career retrospective of Jan Blachowicz.
How did you know? That's actually the first pull. All right, let's see. Let's see which one we're going to talk about first. Oh, look at that. I couldn't even make this up. GSP, number one on the list. Look at that. Unbelievable.
Amazing.
Like Dave Letterman here with throwing cards all over the room and all that stuff. So GSP, for those people that do not know, retired officially today. There were some last minute ice excitement, a little bit of a build that we maybe thought something else was going to happen today, or maybe some last second stuff. But no, he did retire in Montreal, Canada. It was a fairly, I dare say, boring press conference. I was listening to it and it was just, you know, pretty straightforward. He seemed very happy. The video of that's on our site, and it's very easy to find. But he, you know, did the whole French and English thing, which I thought kind of it was. You're kind of just waiting to hear what he was saying for those people who don't understand French. But it was good. He seems happy, and you know, it was kind of a surprise that this came this week in terms of the news. But yeah, it just I guess your thoughts on when you heard he was retiring and kind of where things go from there.
Well, it really sunk in when he showed up on the podium without a salmon colored jacket. I think once that attire was shelved, we realized that this was going to be a serious announcement from George. It was a pretty big story today in Canada. The two major sports networks up here, Rogers Sportsnet and TSN, carried the press conference. I don't know if it was on a broadcast, but it certainly was on their websites, as were news outlets like CP24, 680 News, Global News. It was a fairly big sports story today in the country. I think that certainly it was an announcement that I don't think comes out of left field by any stretch. If you've been listening to George speak over the past 18 to 24 months, you didn't need a microscope to read the tea leaves on this one that, you know, George, it seemed if the right fight and the right circumstance came together, he would fight. But this was not something that seemed to be a burning desire that he had anything he needed to do. There were probably a few wants left, but there were no needs left in his career.
Yeah, he's kind of been this. It's been weird. We've talked this before, and I've talked about this before with other people on this podcast. Is that the past few years, you know, obviously there was the high of obviously him coming back after 4 years off and defeating Michael Bisping to win his second title, and then having to leave again due to injury, and it just between it just the contentiousness with Dana White. And I was surprised to hear him. Actually, I wasn't surprised to hear him say that today as much as I originally thought, but he was saying he and Dana are on good terms and, you know, considers him a friend or what have you. And I'm sure a lot of that's just kind of things you say when you're really happy. And this is, you know, not to be bitter on your retirement day. But I just I can't help. I think just back at like just how weird the relationship between those two guys got, especially after, you know, 167 and then obviously after a Madison Square Garden show. But that, you know, you would think that a guy that did that much for an entire region, that much that someone that was the star of an entire country, obviously was a mainstream star here. Really, the, you know, wrestling terms, really the best way I've heard put is he's like the Shawn Michaels type, the ultimate babyface. People love to rally behind him. And he drew so much money in Canada, that stadium show and all this stuff. And especially on pay-per-view, as it proven when he came back against Bisping, that people cared about him. And just time after time, he's just kind of like, you know, he's not coming back. He's not doing this. And really just seemed to kind of go out of his way to dismiss any chances or optimism he's coming back. And I was thinking this last kind of stage of his career is this just weird relationship with he and an organization that really, in a lot of ways, needed him. And but just were kind of like, they seemed like they were like, we're good.
Yeah, it's interesting because today when I was kind of drawing the comparison of George St. Pierre, it was to Bruno Sammartino, only instead of Bruno Sammartino having this ethnic fan base in the northeast of the United States, George St. Pierre was drawing from a country, and it was Anglophone fight fans. It was Francophone fight fans who were willing to travel and go to Las Vegas and support his fights. And I think George St. Pierre was an enormous reason for the success that Canada had, and kind of the peaks and valleys of MMA's popularity in Canada coincided with George St. Pierre and what he was doing or not doing in the sport. And that relationship with Dana White, I think very much in terms of a comparison point, you look at Bruno Sammartino and Vince McMahon Sr., that the two, they worked together. They both made a lot of money from one another, but there was always that kind of lingering issue when Vince McMahon Sr. blackballed Bruno Sammartino and sent him, coincidentally, to Canada to work for the Tunnies. And I think with George St. Pierre, it was a number of factors. There was the night of UFC 167 when Dana had that press conference and just ran down George. And subsequently, like, you saw a very different tone from Dana White whenever George St. Pierre would his name would come up. He was dismissive of him ever coming back. And when he was coming back, Dana certainly did not treat it as though it was the savior coming back, even though this was a time when the company needed big stars and George was coming back for that Michael Bisping fight. And today it was somewhat George. It was interesting. It's like he's burying the hatchet with Dana White publicly in this press conference, while at the same time making it very clear this fight with Khabib Nurmagomedov is not happening, not because of any of the principal fighters involved, but because of the UFC, chiefly Dana White, ultimately this coming down upon.
So I was thinking about this whole Khabib St. Pierre thing today on my drive, and I was just a few different things, some conflicting thoughts. So my first thought was I'm shocked that they did not try to make that fight because, as we mentioned, they love making money and they need to make money. And this, you know, that is to me, that's an easy, you know, 1.5 million pay-per-view buy fight. Easy. Could be even more than that. I don't think you're going to get, you know, McGregor Khabib numbers, but I think you build that right, you place it right. I think you do like really, 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 really well. I think everyone kind of knows that. So the fact that they walked away from that, I'm curious about that because they've shown a propensity in the past, you know, couple of years or so to really make fights that from a star standpoint make sense and kind of like fan service type fights. But from a, you know, divisional sense, from a traditional sports sense, you're kind of like, well, wait a minute, there's these other guys that have earned title shots or should be getting this, but for some reason they're not getting the same opportunity. And we've heard all those grumblings and things like that. So we'll kind of start there. Like, are you as surprised as I am that they did not try to make this fight?
I think that the UFC probably has their reasons. And I think that you can look at them, you know, they look at it from this standpoint that we are going to put together this fight and market this fight and put all of our resources into it. And do we have the assurance that George St. Pierre, win or lose, is still going to be available to us, specifically if he wins this fight? And I don't think they were ever going to get that assurance. I think George St. Pierre, very much it's fight by fight and seeing where his head's at if he wants to continue this. The idea of being a fighter that is going to fight two times a year, those days are over. Now, I could say in a different world, the meritocracy and who is owed a title fight and the Tony Fergusons of the world, I think all of that makes sense, but not in this incarnation of the UFC that has had no problem moving guys who are rightful contenders to a title fight aside when the bigger money fight can be made. This has been a company that I think ever since it was sold, it's very much felt like they are at the blackjack table and they are simply playing for tonight. They are not playing for our savings down the road and preserving the pedigree of the sport and contenders and building this as such. It's always been, what is the biggest fight we can make today? And today, that biggest fight appears to be George St. Pierre and Khabib Nurmagomedov. And I don't feel that a loss necessarily is going to hurt either guy at this point. If that is the fear, that George St. Pierre outclassing Khabib Nurmagomedov is going to decimate him as a star, I don't see the precedent where one loss is fatal to a guy's drawing power. We typically see guys regress over a series of performances and years of declining skills, where you see an Anderson Silva who, he was not hurt dramatically by the first Chris Weidman loss. It was a progression of performances and guys that he was facing that you saw that kind of decline in his drawing power. So I didn't think that there was much risk in putting this fight together if you had the two principals that were willing to do this fight, other than, you know, they can put up a lot of these defenses, but I don't think they hold a ton of water if both sides are being honest that they were willing to do the fight. And also, at what price was George wanting to come back at? That's probably a big question too.
And so then I started thinking, okay, I was really interested in seeing that fight. And part of it's like, okay, could you just do a main event without the title online? But part of the part of the story is St. Pierre trying to go for three titles in three divisions. And then I was thinking, you know, I was kind of like, oh, why didn't they just do this? And then I was thinking, oh my God, like, this is, it's not, they've conditioned me now to think of like, oh, why not just make the biggest fight possible, you know? And now we're thinking the complete opposite direction. And it's this weird conflict of like, you want the big fight, but even though these other fights could be just as good, but you almost kind of want the, you want the, you want the bigger story, right? And that's, that, and I was just like, oh my God, this past couple of years, they completely ruined me. And then I was thinking, you know, if they don't make this fight, but yet if Brock Lesnar ends up getting the title shot against Daniel Cormier later this year, you know, to me, that's like completely hypocritical of them. Like if they don't want to hold up this other title, if that's one of the reasons that they don't want to give him the opportunity, and then he vacates it if he wins it and so on. You know, it's like I can understand that. But, you know, you have this other situation here where Brock has not earned a title shot and yet he's going to get one because it's a big money fight. But this one could be a huge money fight. It's just this weird, like they seem to kind of bend the rules to whatever fits them at the time. But for whatever reason, they don't want to do this. And, you know, they say they have a plan. And the other thing, too, though, is like Khabib, we have no idea when he's going to fight again. You know, he apparently it could be this fall if that's what he wants to do. And it seems like, you know, he's pretty ardent against that or set on doing that. I just, you know, I wonder if this pisses him off even more. He's like, look, I want this big fight. And I don't know. It's just kind of like trying to work through all that of just you have this fight that they could make is huge, but they are not going to do this one. But then other ones, they're going to show no hesitation in making these big fights. It's just very, very weird, very almost hypocritical.
Yeah. And the Brock Lesnar comparison is a good one because, you know, Brock Lesnar challenging Daniel Cormier for the heavyweight title, it's really not a fight designed for your future in any sense, because both of those guys would probably be looking at their final fight if they were to face one another. It's you know, a situation where you, regardless of the winner, you could end up with a vacant title. But that said, you get a one night huge, huge business fight from those two. It's not all that different with George St. Pierre, that putting him in a championship situation. And I think that the UFC is right to be cautious that this guy could win the lightweight title and vacate it. In fact, I would bank on that happening. I think that George, he's not in the mindset of wanting to defend a title, but wants to be adding championships to his resume. So that's a bit of a conflict as well for George, that you are putting the promotion into a difficult spot, but are also coming back. You will make them an enormous amount in one night. And it's quite a reverse of, it would be one thing if the UFC had really put their foot down over these last number of years and been promoting as such, and that's been out the window. That has not been a concern of theirs at all, whether an interim title is necessary, whether something makes sense about someone coming up in weight for an immediate title fight. It's always been, what is the biggest money fight and we will make it. And this is one instance where the juice isn't worth their squeeze, apparently.
So I saw him fight in person once, and that was I was actually hanging out with you guys a lot during that week up in Montreal. That was him against Nick Diaz, the infamous Wolf Tickets press conference and all that. That was a really fun week. It was amazing just to walk around the city.
That was the most chaotic fight week I've ever covered, because every day there was something new with Nick Diaz. It was insanity.
That was the most chaotic you've ever covered, is that week?
You know what? I take that back. UFC 200 was the most chaotic fight week. But 158 was very close to that. As I recall, UFC 200, that was the most chaotic. But Nick Diaz, you remember, it was the open workouts that I think he missed. Mm-hmm. And then there was him and his complaints about the plane that he was on and the water that they had and then the Wolf Tickets. Yep. And every day it was something crazy from Nick Diaz. And it had this weird build to it throughout the week that from Monday to Saturday, that fight was so much bigger on Saturday night than it was on Monday morning.
Yeah, no, I would agree. Is there one fight that and you saw him obviously a bunch because he fought in Toronto and so on. Was there one fight that was talked about with him or that you would have loved to see him have that we didn't get to see? One, I don't want to say a dream fight, but one you're like, God, I wish we could have seen that fight other than the Khabib fight.
Yeah, You know, I think that certainly over the last 2 years, the Conor McGregor fight was there. Mm-hmm. And I think that both sides, you know, I think at different times, each guy wanted that fight and the circumstances just didn't work out. If you remember at UFC 196, that was the night that George showed up and was sitting there in the crowd. And then Nate Diaz beats Conor McGregor. I guess that's the what if Conor wins that fight, would that have been UFC 200 that year? It seemed like that's the closest that they came. So I just think from a promotion that had the potential to be the biggest fight in UFC history at a time when pay-per-view was exploding for this company. They were doing record numbers with Conor, and you attach George St. Pierre to that equation. I just think that there was an enormous potential with that fight. When it comes to his run as welterweight champion, I mean, he fought pretty much the who's who. I think from just an interest standpoint, it wouldn't be the biggest fight of his career, but him against a prime Tyron Woodley that we've seen, I think that's a really engaging fight to see as well, and the pressure he could place upon George. But I put Conor up there pretty big because that just seemed to be a fight that had the two sides been able to get onto the same page at the same time, who knows what the business was that those two could have drawn.
I agree. Conor number one for me, and number two is the Anderson Silva fight. And I realize they're two different weight classes, but you know, I started really watching UFC after, you know, starting with the Tough era, Tough one after Raw, just like so many other millions and millions of people. That was my entry in. Obviously I knew, you know, Liddell and Ortiz before, but really didn't understand the sport until Tough one. And these two guys were just, they were the guys, you know, these were just these two figureheads, these divisions. And you know, when you talk to so many people that fell off, that kind of got shaved off during that era, eventually, you know, they started adding more shows and in the decline, these lapsed fans, they still remember Silva and GSP, and they still would talk about them, and they didn't really necessarily understand what they were doing, but that those were the guys that they knew as the dominant players. And to me, if you were able to make that fight, even, you know, this summer or last year, whatever, even this, you know, the fact that they're older and what have you, that was the, you're still going to pop a major, major, major buy rate. I mean, people just would doubt. That's one of those fights that, you know, when people talk about Liddell Ortiz 3 and they expect all these old fans to be like, oh, yeah, we, you know, we used to love watching these guys, and they knew they were over the hill. You have that UFC machine behind it. That fight would have been like massive, huge. I just would have loved to see it. I don't know what it would have actually looked like, but to me, that was the one that I was kind of hoping that, you know, one last. To me, the perfect scenario would have been both guys have that fight and both of them retire after that, no matter what. That would have been, to me, the picture-perfect ending of both their careers.
Yeah, I go back to the first BJ Penn fight, which was the UFC 58 card. That was the U.S. versus Canada card, and that seemed to be – like, it was a very close fight between the two, but that was really the eye-opening moment that George St. Pierre was going to be a significant player and the heir apparent to – the welterweight throne. And then that sets up the rematch with Matt Hughes, and that really was his crowning achievement. And that's followed by the Matt Serra loss, and in some ways the Matt Serra fight, that's going to be what so many people go to, and in a weird way the most important fight of his career, because George changes everything at that point. The people around him, management, everything is changed, and he could have gone many different directions after a loss like that. And instead, he simply had to reassess everything and never lost another fight in his career. And while that fight is going to be attached to him and his legacy, I think that it's more impressive how he came back from that fight and who he beat afterwards, including avenging the Serra fight in pretty easy fashion the next year.
Final question on GSP. Do we see him at AEW, Double or Nothing, coming up this summer? I couldn't even get that on straight.
I mean, yeah, it's gonna be, maybe I'll be Cody's mystery opponent.
Oh,
it's
my
George
God.
St. Pierre.
Imagine that. That'd be the best. If all of a sudden he's like, I'm going to go into wrestling. It'd be so great.
Maybe he'll show up at Madison Square Garden WrestleMania weekend. We'll get Rush versus Roosh.
That's why you're the best in the business, John. Well done. Let's see. Let's go to topic number two. I'm going to go through here. Let's see which one I pick. And it is, oh, this is one you're probably pretty familiar with. Post-wrestling, John. You will be one of the figureheads, obviously, of post-wrestling, co-founder, you and Mr. Ting. doing a lot of good things. You're on the, obviously, the Patreon's going well. You have stuff on YouTube, the free podcast, the paid podcast, all that good stuff. One of the best podcast download numbers that we've ever done on this show is when we did the kind of the history of the kind of the launch, the story behind the launch of Post Wrestling. A lot of people are obviously interested in that. That was how long ago was that? About like a year and a half ago, almost.
We launched the site. It was Christmas Eve 2017 was when the site went live.
Got you. So you had one full calendar year under your belt. And as we sit here today, obviously it must still be going good. How are things going? What's been, you know, good stuff, surprises, all that stuff?
Well, I think that certainly the following we've been able to bring over with us, it's been really great to see that many people are following us and interested to hear from us on such a weekly basis, daily basis. So, I mean, myself and Wade, like this is enough right now that this is able to support us for our full-time jobs. So it's been a lot of work. It's probably been more than we anticipated it would be. When we launched it, we had given ourselves 8 months to see where this was going to be by the summer of 2018. And at that point, we kind of sit down and say, okay, we will put everything we have into these 8 months and treat it like our full-time job and see where it is come the summer. And we got to that point, and it was enough that it was enough to sustain us to do this. I mean, we're not millionaires, but it's enough that it's something that we can dedicate all of our time to. So it's just a lot. Like we do have other contributors on the site, but it's largely the day-to-day is on myself and Wei. So it's more work than either of us have been doing. And it's also a lot of different stuff. Like it's the news, it's the podcast, like that takes up time, but it's also the extra stuff that you don't really go into assuming the amount of time something like incorporating is going to take, and putting together a shareholders agreement, yeah, and scouting out an accountant, for instance. And it's all the business stuff. And Wei has kind of been on top of launching our store, which we're now selling merchandise as well on our own. We're also now kind of delving into more live shows, one of which we're doing WrestleMania weekend on the Sunday in New York. So it's kind of just been a baptism by fire in terms of like the learning process of it's running the company, but also it's ours. So that's kind of it was the goal when we started this thing, to have something that is ours that we can kind of shape, mold in our vision, and see what the mistakes are along the way, learn from them, and take feedback from people as well to see what they like, what they don't like. And we've been able to find that it seems to be a lot of people are interested in kind of the chemistry that Wei and I have, and they seem to give us a lot of leeway of what we talk about. Like we did a one-off review of a Marvel film, and it got just so much feedback that we kind of incorporated that. I don't know why anyone would want to listen to my thoughts on a Marvel film, but it's kind of that's what it is. It's like we throw stuff against the wall. Hopefully most of it sticks with people, and it seems to be that, you know, I went into this with a lot of hesitation of how many people really are going to spend money on something that was available to them for free for so many years through live audio wrestling. And I think it's a lot less of people looking at how many shows they're pumping out and kind of like doing the math themselves. It's more so they have taken the goodwill that we put out with all those free shows and just wanting to see this thing succeed and kind of being happy with that. And we've kind of balanced that with the free content as well. I think that's a big thing, to have the combination that I know Brian and Dave do their occasional free shows as well. I think it's really important to have that extension to people that maybe they don't want to spend money for bonus content, but there's still an avenue for those listeners and viewers as well.
Mm. With the criticism these days, especially with companies, like I need to ask Dave about this at some point, because I'm interested in what he has to say. Is, but you know, you get so much, you know, there's so much negative feedback on Twitter and things like that with everything. People complain about everything, right? So how, I'm always interested how business owners, and you know, from big to small, how they are able to essentially kind of pick out the signal from the noise, right? Because there's so much stuff, but like, what you don't want to do is you don't want to, you don't want to completely dismiss. You want to find like the criticism that and constructive criticism that is valuable to take to heart. And some people just don't do that well. And I was curious, you know, with you mentioned getting feedback from people and so on. If you had to kind of learn how to adjust and if people are like, we don't like this, and be like, how do you determine what to be like, these are just people bitching versus like, okay, maybe we should change something or make an adjustment or take these suggestions.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I like to think I'm pretty thick-skinned about criticism, but I think like anyone, it's kind of just how a comment's presented to you in how significant you're really going to take it. Like typically it's an opinion that someone's going to have the biggest issue with rather than how you're presenting something or, you know, like I went into this and I didn't know what the feedback would be like that. Here are these guys that are putting out shows, but also there's like a paid component to it. And I think it's been way less than I thought, but occasionally I'll get like the comment about, I've got to pay to listen to this show. And it's like, I understand that. I totally get that. At the same time, it's like, I look at myself of things that I listen to or I watch that certainly have a value for me. And it's like, in 2019, I think that the audience is progressing more that, you know, this stuff does not support itself. And we've seen what's happened with the newspaper industry, for instance, who like many just decided we're going to put all our content up there for free and now are trying to backtrack and create paywalls. It's like you've kind of introduced what your model is and now trying to adjust it. And now we're seeing kind of the fallout of that, where you're seeing so many jobs lost. I don't think anyone wants to see that. It's things that you value, and there is a cost associated with it at times. So I think people are pretty understanding about that. And that, at least for me, was kind of going into this. I expected more than I received of that. And then when it comes to other criticism, like I'm really trying to pinpoint it. Like I'm not someone that is all that adversarial on Twitter.
Get out of here.
I go through a lot of times now where I avoid even reading mentions, because like there are times when someone will send something to you and it's just you're in the wrong headspace and you don't want to hear it, and it's right there in your face. And I'm just not someone that has the capacity to engage and go back and forth. And it's just, I think that comes with the territory though. If you are putting your voice out there, if you're putting your work out there, you have to be ready to get criticism for it, especially where it's going to be heavily opinionated. I mean, people are going to disagree with you. I'm always fine with that kind of thing. It's when people get into insults, and I think I'm fairly lucky in that I kind of avoid kind of the vitriol of Twitter. I stay away from YouTube. I think YouTube is the comments are the cesspool of the world. So I think you just kind of know your boundaries as well. It's like the best advice I have heard recently was, I can't remember who it was, but it was stating Twitter is not real life. And I think that's a very good description. That like I will never get criticism by email. I certainly never get criticism in person. And it's Twitter. It's like there's a certain performance art on Twitter. Like you are on a stage and you are interacting with somebody, with an audience that are your followers. And it's someone trying to engage with you, knowing that there are who knows how many people watching your conversation. And I think that kind of takes any authenticity away from a meaningful dialogue on Twitter. It can be had, but also with the knowledge that it's to a degree a performance of what is happening on Twitter.
Yeah, we had our situation here at the site, as you know, Dave is
Dave on Twitter?
He is. Yeah, he just signed on. Yeah, I just started an account the other day. The other guy's been it's a complete fake person. The other one that's been almost at 200,000 followers and all that stuff. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard this before. Everyone seems to think we're co-opted by AEW, which is hilarious. They think that we are, just because Dave is good friends, associates. Kenny Omega loves talking to him. You know, whatever it is, they just think we are. So we had after the the ticket launch event, was it like 2 weeks ago or whatever it was in Vegas. We had just a bunch of different content on the site. And obviously it's like, it's one of the biggest stories in wrestling in like, what, 5 years. I mean, it's just, it's huge. And you know this, like, it's just a big story. Everyone's curious about what's going on and all this. So we had all these stories. So we did a, I do our email program. So I sent an email out linking to all this different type of stuff. And then the next day, our one of our editors, our lead site editor, Joe, was like, he's like, man, you, and we can't remember what he said, but basically you're the talk of Twitter today. I'm like, why? He's like, well, the email you sent out, apparently you're trying to sell AEW tickets. I'm like, what the hell are they talking about? So one of the links in the email was to the announcement of the ticket on sale stuff. So it was a link back to our website article about it, which basically said, here's when the on sale is, and that's it. It was basically just kind of a description of that, because that's, everyone was wondering, how do you get tickets all in, or to Double or Nothing, rather. And so it was like the third bullet in this whole other thing about the Omega Jericho thing, all this stuff. And so there was a Reddit thread about it. There was people tweeting about it, and it was like the weirdest thing. Like, so this Reddit chain was like all about how Dave sent out an email with presale codes in it, and he basically like linked directly to the website. It was trying to help. And it's like, no. Like, so finally I jumped in there. I'm like, look, I'm the one who does the email. Dave has nothing to do with it. And kind of explain like everything. And people were just like, you're just trying to sell tickets for AEW. And how can you say you weren't? I'm like, oh my God. I'm like, you gotta be kidding. Like, there, I listen, conspiracy theories are fun. You know, anyone that watches Joe Rogan stuff knows that completely. But like, sometimes there isn't a conspiracy behind everything. It's just, you're just trying to get news out there. You're trying to get content. And people were like, oh, and this guy was starting to engage me over email. And I could tell his questions were kind of leading towards something. And then I see him tweeting stuff and like do screenshots of the email I had sent him, which was just a dialogue. I'm like, dude, you can't do that without saying. He's like, well, I didn't put your name. It's like, this is just the weirdest thing. It was just a very strange day. So I don't know where I was going with that, but like feedback and all that stuff, like basically the internet is very weird. I think we can all agree about that.
Well, I think it's something that it's probably bigger than just wrestling or mixed martial arts media, that I think that there's a general, I think, I don't even want to say skepticism, but I think that there is this, people are kind of, they form a conclusion, and then it's trying to find the trail that leads them to that conclusion. But they're right, starting off at the end spot of like what they believe, and then it's coming back to kind of prove their theory right. And I think often it's unfounded, and I think that it's something that, you know, media as a whole right now, I think that there are people that look at it, and it's like, I always hate when it's like just the general term, the media, because that takes on so many incarnations. And, you know, I flip it around to us that, you know, if I were to paintbrush, like, all wrestlers are blank, and like, that would be so irresponsible, because there's always going to be, like, you just can't cast such a wide brush. And I think that's where we are now, that it's like the media is just like this just giant entity, and people feel it's like so, I don't know. It's like ultimately people are going to find their conclusions in, like, if they read something that they don't want to believe, it's not because the story is going against their own conclusion. It's that there is something at work here. And
right.
Why is this disproving what my beliefs are?
Yeah, people are very adverse now to saying that they're wrong or admitting they're wrong. And that's part of life. That's a great part of life, is you're like, huh, I thought this, I researched this, and I found I was wrong. But people don't want to be wrong, and they stay in their own bubble. It's very, yeah, it drives me crazy. My friends I consider myself a moderate, and I have some very conservative friends. When they start going against the media and they're like, oh, the media is for this and the liberal media. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ, shut up. I can't take it. Cause it's like, you're basically saying social media. That's really what you're saying. And we were just talking about this the other day, like website. And this happens in the wrestling space all the time. People will take a pull quote from something Dave said completely out of context. And this is like, this is the story. This is that. It's like, no, he didn't say that. That's not even – Brian says it all the time in the show. It's like, don't quote me that I'm saying this, like, because he's had it happen to him. And one – people equate website A the same weight as B, C, D, E, F, and G, and so on and down the road. When it's not, there are some institutions that are simply better than others. Just because you put up a site that's powered by WordPress does not mean that your site is on the same levels like the New York Times or the Post or whatever. It's just – but if people can find it, they're like, oh, it's – and they say something they don't like. It's, oh, that's the media too. It's like, it's not. And then social media has this whole other component. Like if someone says something on Twitter – that's a form of media, but it's not the people just kind of lump everything together. Like, oh, everyone lies, or I'm like this. Like, well, people are as much to blame for this as anyone. I think sometimes society kind of gets left off the hook. You know, and it's like people have to be smarter, but people don't want to be smarter. People love to be stupid. You know, it's just this weird space to be in when everyone thinks that, to your point, everyone comes to conclusion first and then they work their way backward when it's like, no, that's not really how things work. It's something, there's not a grander plan in place. It just, it is what it is, but that's not as fun to talk about, I guess.
Yeah. And it's like, and I also, like, I sympathize with a lot of, you know, public figures and specifically, you know, fighters, wrestlers, and what they must endure comment wise on a daily basis. I think to be a celebrity and to be active on something like Twitter is beyond my comprehension, because I know I would not be able to do it. And you look at some of the comments that they're inundated with on a daily basis. I mean, it can certainly, it becomes very easy to just cast a wide brush and write off, you know, everything as being, this negative space when you're privy to so much of it. Like, I don't know about you, Josh, when I get, say, 15 compliments and then there's one insult, it's the insult that sticks with you. And I cannot imagine, like, there is just some awful things that are sent because it's this belief that this, you know, this performer, this celebrity, it's like this guard is down and I have access to speak to this person and can say anything without any repercussion. And I find it amazing that you see so many people that leave Twitter, and it's not surprising because no one needs that in their life when there's so much of that and it gets clouded, that suddenly it becomes easy to have a very negative opinion of the public, of the media, because it is all grouped together by this access that comes in your phone, a very personal item on your phone, that these comments are right there on your screen coming at you, that you can, after enough time, it's probably very easy to just dismiss everything and have a very negative opinion of the public.
Yeah, that was 2 months ago when Dana White basically was like, you know, I don't really care what people say. I don't take anyone's opinion. I just kind of run with it. And yeah, I wonder and I worry sometimes about organizations like that, WWE, wrestlers in general. But, you know, there is some level of critique that is valid. And I wonder for pro wrestlers, it probably doesn't mean much for them to take criticism on matches and things like that from people on Twitter and social in general, because you're just not going to get, you know, people that haven't done it. I assume, you know, Seth Rollins is like, geez, I'm sure he'd rather take his critiques from people that are in the business and, like, you know, fellow performers, whatever, like that, as far as like how he can improve or whatever. But, you know, for organizationally, I worry sometimes that these companies just insulate themselves of, you know, look, everyone's a critic, everyone hates us, all this stuff, and especially, you know, media types, when there is some valid criticism in there. And part of that is like, you know, from what we see on the outside, here's what we think is not going right, and this is why, here's what is. But if there's like, everyone's a critic, then I wonder how they improve, because part of improving is taking criticism, and especially the constructive stuff, and being like, huh, maybe there is something to that, and being confident in yourself, knowing that, you know, that maybe there is some things you can be doing better, and maybe the fans that pay the money and everything, that they have some good ideas. I just wonder, that's one of the things I worry about with these organizations now. It's like, are they going to be able to take criticism and really take it in and be like, how do we listen to our fans better? And I just, with so much money in, you know, WWE and UFC, where, yeah, they're essentially both set for the next half decade, they don't have to listen. I just wonder how that affects the overall product.
Do you ever wonder how Twitter would transform in 30 days if they removed any kind of numerical properties to a tweet and it was just a tweet?
Numerical properties, what do you mean?
Like you no longer get a retweet count, a like count. It is just pure text.
Huh.
And you are not tweeting any, there is no success rate behind a tweet other than it's the words that just stand there.
Hmm.
And
I've heard that. I've heard that thought
before. You're looking at comments.
Yeah, I've heard that thought before. Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing how that would work.
It would never, ever happen because that is the game. That is the video game component of Twitter. Like it's like the ultimate game, like app, because it's a game as well as an engagement tool.
Mm. All right. So final question.
We're just changing the entire world here, Josh.
I know. This is good.
Wasn't this topic post-wrestling? How did we get here? We have a live show Sunday, April 7th, noon, Broadway Comedy Club. That's the end of our chapter on post-wrestling.
I like it. Well, the promos don't come until after this final subject here. So do you watch much Bellator?
I watch Bellator pretty routinely. I'm kind of in and out with DAZN. I don't have the Paramount Network, so it's pretty much just through DAZN that I watch it in Canada.
I think after this weekend, Bellator has become a hate watch for me. And I'll tell you why. I was so frustrated.
Believe me, this is not the weekend to shine a light if you are a Bellator supporter. I mean, these were cards that were they certainly arranged. And I think Saturday's card was a disappointment. And Friday, I mean, that's what can you say about a card that ends in the fashion that Matt Mitrione and Sergey Harrytonov did?
Yeah, and I understand that shit happens, but look, there's no reason for them to have two shows. There's not. They don't have the roster to. Oh God, I'm gonna get upset. No, this is good. Actually, I'm gonna run with it. They don't have the rosters to support this many shows. They just don't. They don't need to be. They just don't. And I don't know. It has to be Viacom basically being like, look, we need content, and you got to figure it out. But it is just so weird how they're doing this. I think if they went to a one show a month model and did the five great fights, and say great fights, like some of these guys, like James Gallagher should not be main eventing a show this weekend. Lorenz Larkin and Andrei Kreshkov should not be main eventing a show in March. They shouldn't, because nobody's going to watch it. It's pointless. Mitrione Karatanov should not be headlining a show. These should be guys third down from the card, like this Chandler Pitbull title versus title fight. That should be a 1-5, like this is the best we got for this quarter, so to speak, and this is what we want people to watch and really create this buzzworthy stuff. That's one of the things with Strikeforce. It was so good. It was just these cards were really, really good. And it, you know, on Saturday they have Terrell Fortune, who is this prospect they've been bringing along for a while. And he's essentially just buried on the prelims that barely anyone watches except the hardest of the hardcore. You couldn't get that guy on the main card on Friday night just to start kind of getting him out there more. He had a fun win that nobody saw. He could have been on the main card for Saturday. It's just weird how they're doing this. And then their main event.
It was also a DAZN card that, I mean, it's not like you have this rigid format that you have to be out in a certain block. Like, yes, it was on Sky Sports, but I mean, we're talking about a two and a half minute fight that Tyrell Fortune was in. And that's certainly a prospect that they have a lot in, at least get that fight on the broadcast. Even being DAZN, that is and again, not going to be your most widely viewed platform.
Yeah. And just the main events this weekend, and I understand things happen, but like that daily fight MVP was just, it was so bad. It was like, if it was two different names in there, it probably would have been like, it would have been, okay, this is a little bit boring, but like there was so much built into this, and their main events, for whatever reason, like the stuff that they really build up, I can't remember the last main event that's been like, my God, that was like a fight of the year candidate. I mean, other than Alvarez Chandler type stuff, that seems to be the only time that they've had like these really great fights. And I keep thinking like, what's it going to take for them to really get over the top? And this is Scott Coker this summer will be 5 years into this thing, with Bellator, which is crazy. It feels like it was just yesterday. And they've done a lot in terms of, making shows that are more buzzworthy, more kind of for the freak show isn't the right word, but kind of the circus sideshow. This guy used to be a big star against this big star. They're both, you know, in their 40s. Let's see what happens type thing. But I don't see this year he's got to make a big step forward, and these shows have to be better, and these guys have to come through for him. And it's tough to say because they're fighters, but like, you build everything up with that MVP Daily fight. One, it was in the UK, which is a joke. And I don't buy it. They couldn't find an arena in the whole country to have that fight in. It just doesn't make any sense. They just never seem to have this blowout like thing that everyone's talking about the next day. It's been like years. And I'm very frustrated because I feel like they should be so much further along than they are, and just they have the opportunity to do a little bit less is more and make these must-see shows, but you know, they have these must-see shows for like the wrong reasons, and then the fight's like, that kind of sucked, and then, you know, we're just kind of right back to square one. It just they seem to make no progress. So I don't know. It's been bothering me like all week as far as just at this past week, and especially you stay up late to watch these shows, and you know, it's just duds, you know. I don't know. So rant over on Bellator. Feel free to jump in and correct me if you think I'm wrong.
No, I think with Bellator, I mean, there's no question that it's interesting because we're seeing this in pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, and that you have the industry leader that is putting out more hours of content than ever before. And I think a certain byproduct of that is less time for the average viewer to watch anything but WWE and UFC. And I think there's that kind of the reverse of a trickle down effect, that you have less time that, you know, on a weekend when the UFC's got a Sunday night card, am I really going to dedicate a Friday or Saturday, much less both, to more fights? And with Bellator, you're right. Like this is the content churning out era. It's just as much as possible. That is what DAZN wants. That's what Paramount wants. And you're serving these two masters now with this DAZN deal that's spending so much money on the Bellator product. They want content. Paramount still has their stake in Bellator. They want their regular shows. That's where they're at right now. I'm sure that in an ideal world, Scott Coker could see that these are cards that could very much be condensed together, and you have more solid main cards. I think that with Bellator, you have so many interesting personalities, and they're in an environment where they seem to be like they don't have the handcuffs on them that some do in the UFC, where it's some fighters, you know, if you break out, you can break out. But for fighters in the middle of the pack, like they very much have the uniform look literally and less of a chance to kind of break out. It's funny that how many UFC stars look at their outlet to break out. It's not on a UFC broadcast, but rather it's going on Ariel Helwani's show. Mm-hmm. And that's, to them, their platform. Bellator, I think, would very much benefit from like a magazine style show, something that where you can get these personalities to engage and build up fights, because that's what Bellator is built upon. It's big personalities that they have. And, you know, Paul Daly and Michael Page, yes, if you listen to Ariel Helwani's show, you probably are aware of this feud. But if you're just strictly watching month to month on Bellator, how aware are you? If you came out of this weekend, how familiar were you with James Gallagher fighting? Was it really hit over the head that the next big card is May the 11th with Michael Chandler and Patricio Pitbull? I think that there's a lot of reliance on, well, the hardcores are aware of these fights that are happening this weekend, but what about the others that they're not living and breathing Bellator? And it's strictly word of mouth, and there isn't a whole lot of it when it comes to the Bellator product. So I think that there's a lot of pieces there, and it's a combination of guys that are names to the public and others that, you know, they have quality fighters and they have some prospects that could be enormous stars, like your Aaron Pico levels, even someone like the what was her name? Valerie Lareda, who competed this past week. And like you have glimpses of potential stars. It's just getting them onto a platform that you can reach people and be able to promote them so that you know these fights are happening and you have a reason to want to watch them fight. I think that's been a struggle for them.
think everyone's going to find out in the next 5 years a crushing reality when it comes to these content deals is that you can have all the money to pay for them, but ultimately somebody's going to watch. And we're going to find out over this next 5 years, you know, especially with WWE ratings and all this stuff. We'll see what happens with AEW and obviously with Bellator and UFC is that, and all, and of course, all these other content platforms as well and deals are being signed is that if people aren't watching, then what's the point of paying all the money for them, right? And it's telling you, man, this content, the content era that we're in, it is short. What did I say? Bad money chasing after good. That's not even the right phrase, but like, I think people are being so short-sighted and thinking, why don't we make something that more people watch and is buzzworthy instead of just being like, here's a show, here's a show, here's a show, here's a show, and the whole like, people will pick or choose. Like, why not make something that they're going to watch every single time it comes out? Cause they're like, we know it's quality. I don't know. And yeah, these executives get paid more than we do, but, yeah.
It's amazing. Like Josh, like we've come up, it's always been, very much, attraction driven in combat sports.
Yeah.
And you have to wonder, like, this is something that's been so interesting to watch. And I'm not the biggest baseball fan, but just watching this offseason, that you have teams now that are making so much off of their portion of the television package that they're getting so many millions of dollars that the incentive has somewhat lowered of if you are a team that you have limited playoff spots in baseball. So do you want to be the ninth or 10th best team and be spending to be the ninth or 10th best team that misses the playoffs? Or do you lower your payroll and you can be the 20th best team with a fraction of your payroll that you're going to be more profitable? And if you're profitable just off the television deal, what is the incentive to pay fighters more when they're making so much money just producing content and putting it out there? I don't think we've seen that in the WWE. Like, it seems like they're now, they very much feel that they are in a competitive environment to retain talent. And it looks like a very good time for wrestlers and conversely fighters. But are we entering like a permanent change where rights fees are going to be so significant that it's going to be less contingent on who's fighting? And it's just simply we are paying for the brand and we are profitable enough that there is not that gun to our head to be able to put on attractions, because that's not the business we're in anymore. It's guaranteed income that we know what we're making regardless of the attraction that we put forward.
Yeah. I just read this week, I read an article about the baseball revenues, and I was curious about how much they brought in. They went over the 10.1 billion mark for 2018. And there was an article I read saying, well, there's some dark clouds within that. And part of it was exactly what you said about these teams basically just choosing to keep more money, their ownership, instead of putting more into the franchises. And it just, there was one paragraph, this thing I read, I'm just like, my God, this sounds like UFC and WWE in terms of just, you know, stuff that they have to be careful of, and that it's, you can make all this money, but ultimately if your attendance is shrinking, your viewership is shrinking, and things are becoming more regionalized, you know, you're having this great stuff now, but it is leading to a house of cards down the road. So yeah, it'll be super interesting to see down the road. We're coming up on the 1 hour mark here, and I want to throw it over to you for some plugs. You talked about the WrestleMania show and all that stuff, obviously post wrestling. And I must put over an interview that you did with Ariel Helwani, not the one that is airing tonight for post subscribers and then tomorrow for free, I believe.
Man, you're on top of things, Josh. Yeah. I'm very impressed.
I know you. I know you, John. I know this stuff. You did one with Ariel when he came up for the Toronto show in December, and he was in studio for about an hour. And I know you guys got a lot of positive feedback, and I think I was one of the people that talked about it. You guys have such a like a synergy, and it's just a comfortableness. That's not even a word, but like you just have a good rapport together. And he said stuff that obviously, you know, he talks for hours and hours and hours a week, but he said stuff on there which he hadn't revealed before about the whole ESPN thing and how SB Nation had not even, or Vox hadn't even made him an offer. It was really riveting. It was really good. Like you guys have a great rapport. You guys do great interviews anyway, but just it. I would urge people to check that out if they haven't already. If you're interested in Ariel or even a little bit, I think it was really good. So well done on that. So I say that, so go ahead and plug away where people can hear that and more great content from John Pollock and Wei Ting.
Well, thanks very much. That was probably the most positive feedback we got for an interview so far on the site was the sit down we did with Ariel. So, I mean, he was incredibly open in that interview about a lot of the changes he went through career-wise last year, leaving MMA fighting, going to ESPN. So I was very happy with that interview at the end. If anyone is not sick of hearing my voice, you can hear more of it at postwrestling.com. We have almost daily shows up on the site with myself, Wei Ting. We have a show called The British Wrestling Experience dedicated to the UK Irish scene. We have Up Next with our two friends, Braden Harrington and Davey Portman. W.H. Park is a contributor. So a lot of great people that are working on the site. And Wei Ting and I, we're doing a live show on Sunday, April 7th. It's at noon at the Broadway Comedy Club in downtown New York. It's $25 for tickets, $20 if you are a patron, which you can sign up for, postwrestlingcafe.com. And it'll be followed by a meet and greet and over with plenty of time for everyone to get to MetLife Stadium for WrestleMania. So that is as much as I can possibly promote without feeling guilty. And thanks, as always, Josh, for having me on. It's always great chatting with you.
I was about to ask if you had any negative feedback for the Helwani interview.
You know what? I seriously don't think I did. And usually it's always like one comment here and there. Now I'm going to open myself up. I'm going to get all these people sending me tweets or whatever. But no, it's it was, I think, all positive feedback from that particular interview. So yeah, though we have just started doing those over the past year. We've just kind of called them like the post round table, and we kind of didn't know what form they would take. And we prefer to just do them in person with people rather than on the phone. And it's just happened. Now it's like, we've done a few of them now. We did ones with, we did one with Conrad Thompson last year during WrestleMania weekend. We've done like a whole series of them now. We did one with Mauro Ranallo when he was here, when his documentary came out. So we kind of, when the right guest is there, we do them and just try to, you know, go in different directions with people, talk about stuff that they don't typically always talk about. And I think that they've turned out very well. We've been very happy with them.
And I want to wrap it up with this. You did one with several journalists, and you donated money to, oh my God, it was around the Crown Jewel. I'm completely blanking, but Bix did it. Yeah, go ahead.
It was a group called the Committee to Protect Journalists. And what we did was, because going into Crown Jewel, like I think many people that cover this, it was a very complex show to do. And I really didn't feel like just doing, you know, our typical rundown of the wrestling show, because it's like, if I was not doing this as my job, I would not be watching this show. Like, I just felt like this was a show not about the wrestling, but still needs to be covered for the very much like the real world issues that are at foot here and that the company is participating in. So what we came up with was an idea to do a show afterwards where we brought on many different guests to kind of talk about a lot of these different issues from all different angles. And we were going to donate $5 for every minute our show lasted. And by the end of the show, we ended up doing a 4-hour show. So you can do the math. And then we made that donation to the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is a very active group when it comes to what a lot of journalists go through. You know, Jamal Khashoggi was someone that received so much attention, but it's like a lot of journalists that are in war-torn cities and that are putting their lives in danger doing this, that I think, you know, if there's anything to take from that horrific tragedy last October, was, you know, putting a light on a lot of these journalists out there that are doing incredible things and putting their lives on the line trying to do it as well. So that was that show we did in November. And I was very proud of that show. It was completely different from anything we've ever done before, but I was glad that we approached it from that angle and looked at it, because I think it was eye-opening for a lot of people that maybe do not follow world politics on a daily basis. I know I learned a lot during that entire stretch, that you see that WWE is doing a show here and then looking at the politics of it and the, you know, the conflicts that it presents.
More like the Pollock ticks.
Not the first time that term has been utilized, but thank you, Josh. What a perfect way to end this.
Yeah, what a perfect way to end this. John Pollock, thanks so much for dropping by. I would say good luck, but as we all know, luck is for losers.
I'm a loser.
All right. Big thanks to John Pollock for stopping by. You can always follow him on Twitter, Post Wrestling, all that good stuff. And if for some reason we didn't mention this during the show, if you're kind of like, I'd like to try some of the free shows, he mentioned during the interview that that he has a lot of those. He does them on, if you watch them on YouTube and also on, obviously wherever you get your podcast, do search for Post Wrestling. They do a bunch of free stuff there as well. And yeah, that Errol Hawani interview, the first one, if you guys are into that stuff, check it out. It's really, really good. And he is, like I mentioned, he talked to Ariel today about GSP and all that good stuff. So that'll be up. I think by the time you guys listen to this, I think it's on their free feed. And I always enjoy the best of worst of shows at the end of the year. They used to do those on the Law, and I really enjoyed those. So we did those for last year, and you can catch those on YouTube and all that good stuff. So yeah, if you need more stuff to listen to and watch, yeah, there's no shortage. Let's see what's going on this weekend. Jan Blachowicz, Thiago Santos headlining UFC Prague. Believe it's Prague, UFC's first, or Czech Republic. Maybe that was it. One of the two. Czech Republic. I think Prague they did last year. But anyway, so UFC ESPN Plus show. Not exactly a ton of buzz going into this one. Let's see what is actually on the show. Let's look up again. There's a Bellator show this weekend. I'm not going to even say anything about that. So on the show, Jan Blachowicz versus Thiago Santos. In Prague, Czech Republic. Prague is in the Czech Republic. What an idiot. What an idiot I am. So there's some names on this show. Stefan Struve in the co-main event against Marcos Rogério de Lima, which could be boring given Struve's history. John Volante. Oh, God. Let's skip right past that one. Liz Carmouche versus Lucy Pudilova. Pudilova had a fun fight at the tail end of last year against someone I'm completely blanking her name, but that was a fun fight. And Carmouche is still hanging around. I was thinking about, you know, I saw her on the show. I saw her that she was on this show. And I kept thinking back to the Rousey fight and what would have happened, you know, to Carmouche if she had that face crank she had on, if she'd be able to get that and Rousey had tapped or something. It just how much life would have changed for her. And she's been kind of buried at the bottom of cards for a long time. Quite some time. She was injured for a while. So, yeah, she's actually, what is going on with her career? Anyway, she basically, so at Rousey fights 2013, she fought two other times that year. She fought once 2014, once 2015, once 2016, once 2017, and then fighting fought once in 2018. So she's, yeah, no wonder I kind of forgot about her. She only fought once a year, won three of her last four, but doesn't really seem that into the regular fighting. John Dodson against Peter Yan on the show. Actually, that promises to be pretty good. Dodson, you know, I think a lot of people kind of think about Dodson. Even I'm thinking about Dodson with his exciting fights years ago. And he's kind of been more of a decision, kind of boring fighter since then. But Peter Yan was really good in his last performance. So that should be fun. And let's see. And there's, a couple on the ESPN. Oh, the prelims are on ESPN too. But really the big one coming after that, UFC 235, John Jones, Anthony Smith. And I assume we'll talk more about that next week. So you've spent a lot of time with us. You have a lot of time in your podcast day. That doesn't make any sense. You have a lot of things to listen to. That's what I'm trying to say. A lot of choices in your podcast day. So I appreciate you spending time with us, anyone else on the site or any of that, dude. Certainly appreciate that. We always say thank you. Should say thank you more. So appreciate the time. So thanks to John Pollock. Thanks to all you for listening. This is Josh Nason. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out. Yours truly is heading to Charlotte, North Carolina in about less than 24 hours. Getting out of here for the weekend. Have a good one. Until next time, insert catchphrase here. Bye.